Night on the Banks.
Each fortnight along the banks of the River Raritan, folk from near and far gather as the round table is convened to discuss matters of concern which range from the heart of Queen's Campus to the far corners of the globe. Now, as all is called to order, we give you the host of Night on the Banks, Stuart Knarr.
Hello and welcome to Night on the Banks. This week, part three of the history of Rutgers. On our first show, we looked at Queen's College, 1766 to 1825. Later, we followed the growth of Rutgers College through the 19th century, and this week we're going to continue the story into the 20th century with, once again, our special guest, Dr. Richard McCormick, professor of history, university historian, and, of course, the dean of Rutgers College. And Dr. McCormick, welcome back.
Glad to be here, Stu.
We started off looking at a college run by the Dutch Reformed Church and then saw the influence of the church diminish over time. Now, as we come into the 20th century, who's running Rutgers?
Well, if we look at the college at the very end of the 19th century, say around the year 1899, it's being run by an historian, oddly enough, by the name of Austin Scott, who had become president in 1890 and was to serve until 1905. His administration was not a happy one. It was a time of many problems for the college, but as has been so often the case, those difficulties were ultimately surmounted, and we were to move forward very nicely in the 20th century.
Now, administrative positions at that time were also being added, and I think in 1901 that includes one that's near and dear to your heart, the office of the dean.
Well, this is a subject of some confusion. We have all kinds of deans. The dean to whom you refer, who was appointed in 1901, was Francis Cuyler Van Dyke, after whom Van Dyke Hall is named. And he had been, at that time, professor of physics for about 40 years. And his role was really that of dean of students. Disciplinary cases were taking up far too much time on the part of the president and the faculty. And so Professor Van Dyke was appointed to the position of dean of students without remuneration, and virtually all he did was handle cases involving students who'd gotten into one kind of difficulty or another. So it was a very modest kind of beginning toward the establishment of an administration within the college.
So there was still no real structured administration with...
Well, you'd hardly need it, because at the time of which we're speaking, let us say around 1900, the total student body of the college was only about 250, which I guess is about the number of students that you might have in, let's say, Brett or Tinsley. And consequently, it didn't need a great deal of administration. The only administrator, really, in the college at that time was a very remarkable man by the name of Irving S. Upson, who filled the roles of secretary of the faculty and registrar and librarian and just about any administrative chore that had to be taken care of. It was done by Irving S. Upson. He's really the father of the hundreds, if not thousands, of administrative people we have around the university now.
Today, in 1976, especially this time of year, we're in December now, you can hear a lot of students complaining because exams are now going to be after Christmas, the schedule has been changed back and forth, and at the beginning of the century, there were being changes made in the academic program, but also in the calendar, too, and we went from a three-term calendar to a two-semester calendar. How was that what was the reaction to that at the time? Was that greeted with enthusiasm, or was it with about as much enthusiasm as the calendar change was today?
No, it was a favorable reaction, because without going into all the arithmetic of it, that three-semester system extended over a longer period of the year than our present two-semester system does. That is to say, they were going to school into July, and it was a remnant, really, of a system that went way back to the 18th century, and Rutgers was rather slow, as a matter of fact, in adopting the two-semester system, which by that time had been adopted by most of the leading universities in the country.
You already mentioned that there were only about 250 students at the time. This is around the turn of the century, a little after. When did that begin to change? When did that start to at least double? And students actually began to make Rutgers a much bigger institution.
Well, the period of the 1890s was something of a low point. Actually, enrollments declined, in part, I think, as a consequence of the financial depression that hit the country in 1893. And we begin to come out of that around 1900. But the major change takes place when we get a very extraordinary new president in 1906, William H. S. Demarest. Dr. Demarest had been a graduate of the college in 1883. His father had been a graduate before him. Indeed, he had ancestors going all the way back to the beginning of the institution. And he was, in my view, one of the two or three really great presidents that the college had. And he was to be president from 1905 to 1924, a period of 20 years. And during his administration, the enrollments in the college, or by the time he left, we should say the university, increased about sixfold. So that it was a time, the Demarest administration, of very considerable growth, development, expansion, change in virtually every area of the college.
As the curricula and then the number of students changed, how did that affect the entrance requirements and what it took to get into Rutgers? Did it become stricter, or was it easier because they wanted to have more students at the school?
Well, there were many things changing in the field of American education early in the 20th century. One of the chief factors of change that was to impact on higher education was the very rapid development of high schools. In general terms, high schools had been relatively scarce before 1900. By the 1920s, they're becoming common. And so that whereas previously the college had relied chiefly on private preparatory schools for its students, increasingly as we move into the 20th century, the students who come to us come from public schools. By the 1920s, over 80%. And this set up a whole new set of requirements in the area of admissions. It has to become more systematized, both because of the vastly increased number of schools and also because of the increasing numbers of students applying for the admission, for admission. And very briefly, in the 1920s, we begin the system, which is now familiar to so many students, of looking at such things as rank in class and board scores, although they were a different kind of test that was given then, and Carnegie units. That is to say, the requirement that we still have, that a student have a certain number of units in high school representative of a broad range of academic studies. So that essentially in the 1920s, you begin to see something approximating the modern system of admissions, replacing the relatively informal system that had maintained when there were a small number of private preparatory schools sending their students to us.
All right, maybe looking at the first decade or two of the 20th century, as more and more students came, I imagine the physical size of the college also had to vastly change, just to keep up with it at least. What new buildings were added? Well, let's make it up to about 1910, 1920, that period.
Well, let's talk about the Demarest administration, let's say between 1906 and 1924. There were a great many additions, most notably what was then the engineering building, now Murray Hall, which was built about 1905. And then came Miller Dollar Hall, which at that time served the School of Chemistry, and that opened in 1906. Then there was the construction of the Ford Dormitory in 1914. At about the same time, the beginnings of construction at what is now Cook College, the Agricultural Administration building over there. It was the first building, I think, about 1914. And then, of course, when we move into the period after 1918, there is a considerable development of buildings at what was then the New Jersey College for Women, now Douglas College. So that the Demarest administration was a time of not only expansion in numbers of students, but quite obviously very substantial additions to the physical plant, both in terms of educational buildings and dormitories.
All right, I do want to get back to the new colleges a little later on,
yeah.
But first, let me just ask a question that seems to have plagued us for all 211 years, and probably still well for quite a while at least, the financial condition of the college. Once we come into the 20th century, and the school, of course, by then is quite an old institution, where's the money coming from now, and is it enough?
Well, as we discussed last time, Rutgers was designated as the land-grant college of New Jersey in 1864. However, this did not lead immediately to any state funds for the institution. In 1890, the state decided to create state scholarships, which would be available to students attending Rutgers. Those scholarships were created, students came, but then the state refused to fund them. So for 15 years, the college admitted students, presented the bill to the state, and the state refused to pay. Finally, in 1905, after Rutgers had instituted a lawsuit, the suit was settled, and we got a sizable amount of money representing the back payments on those scholarships. Then shortly after that, the state began a policy of making specific appropriations for particular departments or phases of work. The earliest of these appropriations, early in the 20th century, was for ceramics. Then gradually it was extended to short courses, to courses in agriculture, to courses in chemistry. Rather than a general appropriation, these were very specifically tied to particular programs of the college. And during the course of Dr. Demarest's administration, the income that we were receiving from the state rose from a level of roughly $50,000 to a level of nearly $1 million. So there was a tremendous increase in terms of state support. At the same time, there was a considerable amount of federal money coming chiefly to support work in agriculture, coming under the so-called Second Morrill Act, the Hatch Act, and other pieces of legislation that were passed in the 1890s and afterwards. So that if we look at the college, let's say, around 1920, approximately a third of the money is coming from the state, about a third from the federal government, and about a third from tuition and endowment and fees.
As these relations with the state and the government grew closer and closer, whatever happened to the relation that used to be there with the church? I mean, was it still there in at least a paternalistic way, maybe, or did it slowly just phase out?
It phased out over a whole period of roughly 60 years between the 1860s and 1920. As late as the 1910s, there still existed the requirement that two-thirds of the members of the Board of Trustees, for example, must be members of the Dutch Church, and the president must be a member of the Dutch Reformed Church. But to put it in a nutshell, in 1920, by agreement with the church, all church connection was severed. So that after 1920, there was no connection whatsoever, no requirement with respect to the membership of the board or the president or anything else. As of 1920, we became completely divorced from that long tie with the church that had extended back to 1766.
Today at Rutgers, the sports program, which of course is very important these days in college, is definitely changing here with nationally ranked football and basketball teams, even after a recent disappointment. The new field house is under construction. The program is gaining in recognition and respect throughout the state and the country. Last time you were here, we discussed the beginning of Rutgers sports. But now at this point in our look back, it's over 30 years now after the inception of Rutgers athletics, a change takes place in the running of the athletic association and thus the athletic program of the college, doesn't it?
Yes. Down through the 19th century, the athletic program was operated almost completely by the students. It was a student enterprise, just as, let's say, WRSU is. The students had an athletic association. They paid dues toward it. Those dues, with other income, was used to go out and hire a coach. The coach didn't go out and recruit the students in those days. The students recruited the coach, which I think might have been a better situation in some ways. But then in the 20th century, the situation begins to change. The alumni move in. A very powerful member of the Board of Trustees by the name of Leonore F. Lurie organizes a group of alumni known as the Rutgers Associates, and they decide that they're going to make Rutgers bigger time. This is not the first time we've gone bigger time. And one of the consequences was the construction of a field house at the athletic field at that time. Incidentally, the athletic field then is where Records Hall is now located. That was Nelson Field. And they improve the field and provide stands and move into the management of the thing and hire coaches. And it reaches something of a culmination around 1913 when a very extraordinary man by the name of George Foster Sanford was brought in as football coach. It's a very interesting arrangement. Sanford was not paid as coach, but he was in the insurance business, and Mr. Lurie, who recruited him as coach, he was not recruited by the president of the university or anything like that. Mr. Lurie arranged for Mr. Sanford to come down and be coach. And his compensation was the business that he received from the Delaware and Hudson Railroad. Lurie was president of Delaware and Hudson for handling insurance business. So that we got the coach, in effect, for free. Well, he was a very extraordinary coach. And within the space of a couple of years, Rutgers was recognized as a national football power, playing the big teams of the day. And in the 1915 season, and again in the 1919 season, being recognized. We didn't have an official top 20 teams in those days, but certainly the record compiled by Rutgers in 1915 and 1919 put them in the equivalent, let's say, of the top 20 of those days. Sad to say, it did not result in a great influx of money into the college, either from the state or from the alumni. But it did, of course, produce a great deal of interest among the student body and did attract a certain amount of attention to the university throughout the country.
Now, there were some new sports beginning at the time, right? And one, I think, was swimming, but another was something called basketball.
The class of 1908 takes credit for having introduced basketball. Of course, basketball was a new sport, having originated only in the 1890s. But it comes very slowly into the picture, and down to World War I is still, I guess you'd say, in the category of a minor sport. But after World War I, it rapidly, of course, acquires popularity and assumes major proportions here. Then swimming in the 1920s under the leadership of Coach Riley, who was a very extraordinary man. The Rutgers swimming team achieves national prominence, usually coming close to having undefeated seasons, but on more than one occasion having those undefeated seasons spoiled by Yale, which was then the great swimming power that period.
In 1917, the year you already mentioned, for the first time, the term state university is used, yet it doesn't mean the same thing that it does today.
Hardly.
What did it mean then?
Well, Stuart, that's always a difficult question to answer. Back in 1864, the Board of Trustees had created something called the Rutgers Scientific School, which became the land-grant college of New Jersey when it was so designated by the state. And then what happened in 1917, the state passed a law specifying that this land-grant college, this College of Agriculture and Mechanic Arts, maintained by the trustees of Rutgers College, should be the State University of New Jersey. So in brief, what you had was the State University of New Jersey run as sort of a department of Rutgers College under the Board of Trustees of Rutgers. It was a very peculiar situation.
Much easier to understand these days.
Right, and that designation of State University was removed around 1929 with the readjustment in the state relationship that was associated with the creation of state board of regents.
Of course, also in 1917, the United States enters World War I, and it does have quite an impact on the school, and there's, I think, particularly something called SATC, which affects a number of students at Rutgers.
Yes, the SAT was the Army Training Corps, the equivalent of the ROTC, and in effect, most of the students in the college at that time, those who remained in 1918, were put into uniform and drilled and took a certain amount of military work along with their academic studies. I might say, however, that the World War I didn't have nearly the drastic impact on the institution that World War II had. For one thing, of course, the World War I, American participation was much shorter. And moreover, in World War II, there were different policies with respect to drafting college students than there had been in the First War. In the First War, it was easier to get deferments for one reason or another than it was in the Second War.
After the war is over, women still don't have the vote in this country, but educational opportunities for women were improving. I think especially out west, there was co-education was developing. What about at Rutgers? You mentioned NJC before, so I guess this would be a good time to go back into that.
Yes, as of the early 20th century, there was virtually no opportunity for higher education for women in New Jersey. As in many other things, the state lagged far behind in making such provisions. Then in 1911, coming out of the women's clubs in New Jersey, there was a movement led by Mrs. Mabel Smith Douglas of Jersey City to secure the establishment of an educational institution in New Jersey that would meet the needs of women. After many years of campaigning, Mrs. Douglas and her associates finally succeeded in persuading the trustees of Rutgers College to set up what was called in those days a coordinate women's college. The trustees were still not prepared, of course, for co-education. It would take them another 50 years before they were ready for that. But they did agree to establish a college for women separate from the men's college. So this brought into existence in 1918 what was then called the New Jersey College for Women, now Douglas College.
And then in 1921, a third college is added, and now Rutgers really is becoming a university, isn't it?
Which college? The College of Agriculture?
Yeah.
Well, that it had, yes, it was actually given a collegiate form of organization in 1921. And then subsequently, a similar collegiate form of organization was created for the College of Engineering. And then finally, and I blush almost to say this, in 1925, the trustees said, in effect, that all units that were not already included in engineering or agriculture or education should constitute the College of Arts and Sciences. So this is how the College of Arts and Sciences came into existence in 1925. But by 1925, then, we do have several collegiate units, as well as a small graduate program. And so in 1924, we took upon ourselves the title of Rutgers University in recognition of the fact that we had moved beyond the collegiate status.
Following that long term of Demarest, Dr. John Martin Thomas becomes president of the university, and during that time, he was making a great effort at trying to make Rutgers really become a university, but was he successful during his 5 years of doing that?
No, Thomas came in 1925 with a definite understanding on the part of the trustees that Thomas was to make Rutgers fully a state university, and of course associated with that was the notion that there would be adequate state funding provided. Thomas's idea was to persuade the state to enact a state property tax, the so-called mill tax, which would be devoted to the support of higher education. And he propagandized very hard for it. He didn't get the tax. Instead, there was created a special commission called the Duffield Commission. And when the Duffield Commission had finished its deliberations, the trustees had decided they didn't want to become a full-fledged state university because they saw some unpleasant implications. Particularly, they saw that the money wouldn't be forthcoming. So the result was that Thomas retired, or resigned, I should say, at the end of 5 years, having failed to accomplish his objective. And the experience left the trustees very suspicious about the state relationship. And we entered into a long period, roughly from 1930 down to 1945, of a sort of status quo but standoffish kind of relationship between Rutgers and the state. There was a contractual relationship which netted the university something of the order of $1 million a year, but that amount didn't grow, the state didn't build any buildings, and generally speaking, it was a fairly stagnant period.
I don't really don't want to rush through that period, but we're closing rapidly with the amount of time we have left. So before we finish, I really want to get to the year 1938, although the world was on the brink of war. There was a day of Rutgers, November 5th, that was left a happy memory, at least, in the hearts of Rutgers sports fans. And maybe you could just talk briefly about that.
Yeah, I lost a hat. 69 years after the first football game had been played, in 1869, and interestingly enough, on the 38th birthday of the football coach Harvey Harmon, and this was in 1938, Rutgers defeated Princeton for only the second time in the long football relationship between those two institutions. And of course, the fact that this victory occurred in the new stadium made it one of the great events of that period in Rutgers athletic history.
Of course, right now we're up to December 7th, 1941, and we're near the 35th anniversary of that day right now. In fact, today, the day this show is being run, and just months after Rutgers' 175th anniversary. Now, the attack on Pearl Harbor, of course, changes the future course of the whole world, but do you think in that uncertainty of the period, the people of Rutgers could possibly foresee how much bigger Rutgers was going to become following which was really the greatest disaster the world had yet known?
No, not at all. There was nothing on the horizon as of 1941 to indicate either the tremendous havoc that the war was going to wreak on Rutgers, nor the very different kind of world that was to come into existence after the war, especially, of course, with respect to higher education and the development of Rutgers.
Dr. McCormick, unfortunately, with one more chapter left to go in this long and fascinating history of Rutgers, we have, in much too short a time, come to the end of this week's program. And once again, my deepest thanks to you for once again taking the time to come to the show and share your knowledge with us all. Sometimes I can't help but think you've been here for the whole 211 years and just look remarkably well for a man of your age.
Well preserved.
I don't want to spread any rumors, so I won't say that. I want to take the opportunity right now to extend an invitation to you for next semester to come back and finish the story of the history of Rutgers.
It'll never be finished.
That's a good way of ending this show, I guess. Perpetual motion. I also want to thank my engineer, Mike Blishak, for his technical supervision and remind you to listen to WRSU next week in this time period to City Hall Perspective with Gary Thompson and Joan Kiesling. If there's any topic of special interest that you would like to hear discussed on Night on the Banks, or if you are involved with something that you feel would be of interest to the listening audience, let us know. Send your ideas along with your name and address to Night on the Banks, WRSU-FM, Rutgers University, New Brunswick, New Jersey, 08903. And please tune in 2 weeks from now at this same time as Night on the Banks reconvenes the roundtable for more interview, discussion, and debate of the issues that shape Rutgers and the world. Until next time, this is Stuart Narr bidding you farewell from the banks of the old Raritan.